I'm Mark Gagan, and you're listening to the Voice of Insurance podcast, produced in association with Advantage Go, enabling enterprise-scale underwriting through a single pane of glass. Today's podcast is a real tour de force with the founding CEO of a maturing Lloyd's market business that is starting to come into its own in its 11th year of trading. Fresh from a takeover by blue-chip private equity investor CVC, and now boasting a sub-90% combined ratio and $450 million in capacity for 2024, Duncan Dale, CEO of Dale Underwriting Partners, is full of confidence and is excited about the opportunities that the market is currently throwing up for his firm. In many ways, Dale Underwriting Partners is a microcosm of the Lloyd's of the last 10 years. The market of the 20-teens was a difficult one in which to start up, but patience and persistence have finally started to pay off. The investment by CVC last year was rightly reported as a reaffirmation not just of Duncan's business, but of the continued attractiveness of the Lloyd's platform itself. This discussion is fun and is a wonderful dissection of the state of the market. It's also an underwriting masterclass with a canny trader sharing his long experience and deep understanding of the US casualty insurance and reinsurance market, the discussion and debate of which has been hogging the headlines for most of the last 24 months. Listen on and hear about the opportunities that are exciting Duncan now that he's grown the underwriting platform and attracted the capital to make the most of them. Enjoy the podcast. Duncan, welcome back to the Voice of Insurance.
Thank you very much, Mark. Nice to be back.
It was just over a year ago we last spoke, but I think the reason why I wanted to get you back was because obviously things change, and things have changed, not to say dramatically, but ownership has changed. You've done a deal with CVC. Tell us what's going to change because of that.
Thank you. Nice to see you. It's been a busy year, as you allude to there. I think one of the things that certainly won't change is the culture of the business. And so one of the attractions of CVC to an organization like us is the culture that we've built up over the years and our position in the market. And so the thing that's very important. What changes, though, is that we have our own balance sheet, and so we have that permanency of capital. And I think that puts us in a different position with respect to executing on our plans, particularly in an improving market.
I suppose any business that's buying into a Lloyd's business knows that a Lloyd's business is a Lloyd's business, isn't it? Is that one of the things that you've got to accept, I suppose, when you buy a Lloyd's business? Say, well, there are certain things you probably can't change about it.
And I guess it depends on the motivations of the buyer as to whether they want to actually change the culture. And you know, I think through getting to know the CVC team, we got to like each other and see how each other thinks. And that was true of other capital relationships that we've had. And I think it's generally true of all business relationships that people understand the way you do things, the way you approach things. And so there's a general buy-in, I think, to that approach. And so why change it? We're different to CVC, and CVC invest in a lot of different companies. There's no intent to change us to them. You know, it might be different if we were a subsidiary of another insurance or reinsurance business. That might be different, that you become a little bit more like them, I would say, over time. But that's not the relationship here.
Well, actually, also, that was something that was well reported in the press. Press certainly went with the line that this is a real vote of confidence in you, but also a vote of confidence in Lloyd's own story and its turnaround and its attractiveness to blue chip, very savvy, very experienced investors.
Excellent timing, I think, for us and for the market. So I think the news did play out well that you've got such a highly regarded investor investing in a balance sheet business and in a balance sheet business in Lloyd's. So I think that definitely has played.
It certainly does seem to be good timing because, of course, you know, any kind of contrarian investor would tell you, you know, obviously, let's say the last 5 or 6 years, we've only been talking about investments going into non-balance sheet businesses, fee-earning businesses within insurance brokers and MGAs specifically being bid up to very high multiples. And of course, balance sheet businesses being rather in the doldrums and being valued at quite modest multiples of book value and sometimes not even, you know, and actually below one value of book. Yeah, I think that would be good timing because I think since this market's obviously turned, there has been a pickup, but there's always a lag with investors picking up on things. So I'd say it was smart on CVC's part to see that.
Yeah, I think there's lag certainly with startups
as well.
I think
it's when they're cheap. I mean, that's always a good place to start, unless they get cheaper, of course.
Well, indeed, indeed. Give a great deal of credit to the team we've got here that we've built the business over 10 years. So we're in a nice position as a business of having navigated through some difficult years. Built the business, built the core lines, built the functionality, built the managing agency. And so a good time to help us to develop up from here. Yeah, without that lag, if you like.
You've got this investment.
One of my understandings, that will mean you'll be a fully aligned business, i.e. that you'll be running your own balance sheet with less support from third-party investors. Is that right? And that's one of the things that the CFC investment is going to go towards.
Yeah, exactly right. So for the 2024 year of account, we effectively write about 82% of the syndicate for 24. So the balance of that, the 18%, will participate for 24 and 25, and then it'll be fully aligned after that.
Excellent. And obviously, you know, you get bought by a big investor. They have a lot of interest in you. They've bought you for a reason. Does that put you under more pressure to grow? Obviously, we've got a good market. They've got capital. Is that the main imperative at the moment? Is that the main message you get from them when you have your board meetings?
No, is a quick answer. I mean, I think the thing that we seek out in a partner and feel very strongly we have in CVC is a great understanding of what builds value. And writing premium that doesn't have sufficient margin in it does not build value. And so...
So you find they're more likely to be listening in a board meeting than they are kind of telling you what they want you to do.
Yes, I think we've only been together for a short period of time in terms of formal governance. But I think the important point is that we've spent a lot of time talking about what sort of business do we want to be? And being bigger just to be bigger isn't the answer. But given that, we still feel that there's lots of opportunities. There's lots of things to do with our current portfolio of business. We're below a market average in terms of scale within Lloyd's. And so if we've got the right teams and the right leaders in our business, then we should be able to take up market share over time. And we see the market growing organically as well. So I think a lot of the thesis of what do we want to be in 3, 5, 7 years' time is a Lloyd-centric, more of the same, maybe some additional lines, maybe some other creative things that we'll do with the platform. But the fundamental is do what you understand and know, and that creates the right sort of business.
Go deeper into things you're already in, but maybe add a few things.
Depends on the cycle, doesn't it? Yeah, we can't predict, as anybody else can't really, about which of our lines of business will be particularly attractive in 3 years' time or not. And so there's an active balance and understanding and approach to making sure that we put ourselves in the position where we're taking the most of the opportunities that are available at the time.
I mean, who'd have thought that property, good old-fashioned bricks and mortar, would come so much back into vogue and to be roaring back? It's crazy. You think that was the growth class of the 19th century, not even the 20th century.
Right, yeah.
And it's back.
Yeah, many people closed their shutters on the open market property portfolio a number of years ago when it's particularly challenging and we had a very small book of it at the time. It was very challenging. But I suppose I'm a believer that in core lines of business, which is really what we're in, each of them will have their time. And as we're at the coalface, we should know whether the time is right or not. And so to actually say we're never going to do this again is a big step, I think. Yeah, I'm not saying we'd never do that, but I think it's a very big step to say we can't ever see a way that the economics around this class of business...
Well, I suppose only if you can see there is no demand for that and products anymore. At some point, you know, oil and gas, well, we expect at some point in this century, there won't be any.
Yeah.
So you should, well, there'll be still some.
I'm sure there's examples, and there's certainly examples where, you know, we don't feel we've got the right expertise or feel for the exposure, and we should make sure that we don't expose ourselves to those things. But I think we're essentially a property and casualty insurance and reinsurance business. And those are big areas of business for Lloyd's. They're big areas of world trade. And so at times, there'll always be demand for that in our view.
Go a bit deeper and stronger in what was your core business and take up more of that growth as those continue to grow. You mentioned about other potential classes. Is there anything that you've got your eye on? And also, having said that, do you build with an idea of saying, oh, look, I think we should get into this class because on paper it makes a ton of sense because I can see it'll make us have a better balanced portfolio. It won't have any extra capital requirements coming along with it, or they're very incredibly modest, so it'll be accretive to our capital, etc. And you think, great, but then who's going to do it? So do you think more in a theoretical sense and then try and find the person to do that? Or do you meet some amazing underwriters and think, you know what, we need to get them because they're going to fit in with us. And then we'll make all the other stuff work.
Yeah,
I think. Which is more important?
It's been a mix of both, I would say. I think the important one is to bring in people that fit with the culture, with the ethos and the goals of the business. I mean, that cuts a lot out, I would say, of what we see. But also balance that with our understanding, our ability to analyze what we're being shown and whether we think that is accretive to what we do. And so I think the combination actually here with CVC and having our own balance sheet and permanent capital does significantly improve our execution potential around opportunities that we want to go after. In the past, I'd say we've mixed opportunistic, here's a team that's available, here's an individual that's available, we think they're really good, we think that fits with what we want, there's a good track record, it fits with the rest of the organization, let's get them in. We have done a bit of, there's a team that we know really well doing something that we don't currently do that we think it would fit too. So we've done a bit of both, I would say. We can be a little bit more confident around the execution of going out and saying, well, if we were to do XYZ, who do we want to go and do it? And let's go and talk to them.
Sorry to interrupt in mid-flow, but this is just a reminder that you could be advertising right here, right now, and getting your message directly into the ear of key decision makers in the insurance industry. And you'll be doing it while they're absolutely in listening mode. The podcast is the medium of the future, and so is audio advertising. Contact me on mark@thevoiceofinsurance.com, and I'll do everything I can to get you started.
As a consequence of the CFC investment, does it mean you get more incoming calls from people say, who've got teams or who would say, you know, you look like you could be a really good home for me that perhaps you weren't on their radar before?
I think yes, although we've always had quite a lot of calls, actually, because I think we've always had a number of opportunities in a hopper of people that look at an independently run Lloyd's business and a business that's focused on underwriting. That is attractive for the right people, I think. And so we've seen a lot of plans. We've seen a lot of people. We probably haven't always made the right decisions of saying no to those, but we have been fortunate enough to have a hopper full of opportunities. I think CVC's broader connections across the industry certainly open a lot of doors as well, actually. I think it enhances what we currently see. And that point about you've got a stability of a balance sheet and a confidence around development of the capital going forward.
Yeah, and the nature of that investment, you're saying semi-permanent or, I mean, I suppose nothing's forever, is it?
I don't know of too much that is forever. I think one of the key things for us is that we're in a long-term fund. And so what we didn't want to have in a partner is a partner that has to get out at a point in time that may not be the time for us. Who knows what the next 3, 5, 10 years will develop. But I think we felt very happy about the mechanics of the investment and where it sits and the motivations behind that as far as CVC are concerned and their investors.
Not just clocks ticking everywhere and timetables.
No, because I don't think that's the reality of our industry, that we can perfectly time a good point into the future where we'll create the most value and have the most attractive business to be perpetuated from there.
It certainly feels like a good time now. Lloyd's results in the aggregate and very specifically are very good everywhere. Does it feel like a golden age? I mean, sometimes I suppose you're in a golden age. You can only tell it was a golden age about 10 years later when you realize, oh, I wish we were back in that market. I wish I'd enjoyed it more at the time.
Yeah, very true. And I think as you see the cycles, I think you become more aware of that.
So you're pinching yourself, remembering to enjoy it while it's good.
You've got to enjoy it. But also I think the messaging's very positive at the moment, I would say, in terms of demand being there. Let's not give back the profits. You know, I mean, I think it's okay to make money at this industry and we're only able to meet the demands and be a sustainable source of risk transfer if we are profitable for our capital providers. And so whilst the market is enjoying good returns at the moment, I think the messaging is very good around there's reasons why that does need to continue and not be a peak that everyone falls away from.
Well, certainly, yes, because if you forget that we're making 20% returns now or 20 plus, but when you add up the previous 5 years, we've made virtually nothing.
Right. So yeah. So I think
it doesn't look so good.
The longer term return is over the last 6, 7 years has been, what, 3, 4%? You know, it's just not good enough.
Below the cost of capital.
Right.
We can talk more about the market a little bit later, but something's happening in the market that I want to ask you about. We're in this quite a key phase of the digitization of the London market. We have Blueprint 2, the key execution points in that, and it's going to be the beginnings of a digital market. And I think people often overestimate how much is going to change in the short term, and then they slightly underestimate what the long-term effects are going to be. We're on the cusp of some quite big changes. Do you feel that there's lots of new opportunities going to come from this?
I feel a lot of it is underpinning the core processes of the market, which need to be updated and more efficient. And if we benefit from additional efficiency from those things, then I think that's all good. Yeah, I think I'm referring there to more of the subscription market infrastructure, digitalization projects there, Blueprint 2. You can't argue against it, I don't think. You know, you want to see those things succeed.
And, you know, productivity and ultimately expense savings.
Yeah. We'd love to see expense savings. We'd love to see data that means something. We'd like to get rid of wasted data that doesn't tell us anything. And so all of those, I think, we would point to. On the broader topic, I think we're interested observers, I would say, in AI and some of those initiatives. I think we feel that there'd be great benefits in terms of data and being able to pull information together and look at those things. Anyone that knows us would not be surprised, I would say, Mark, that we're not going to be leaping to allowing that to make strategic decisions for our business. But can it help challenge those decisions and bring a level of sophistication around what will actually move the dial in terms of individual risks right through to portfolio optimization to broader strategies? Can help inform.
With digital, when a broker can actually just plug in, I mean, that might be quite exciting when you can sort of meld with a broker's portfolio in some way through APIs, through direct connections from their computers to yours. You could be able to see what they've got or what they would like to show you and then be bidding on that. Particularly, do you think that might be able to allow the London market to write a lot more things less manually and obviously things with lower premiums, higher volume? Some of the people I've spoken to would say one of the things they're most excited about is we've got these fantastic bespoke products, but then they're expensive and only really big Fortune 1000 kind of companies can buy them because they're brokered, they're individually tailored. If we can then distill some of that and put that into the AI and then move that down to the mid-sized companies can then buy this sophisticated product that previously only Fortune 1000 type companies could buy, then that would be a really great thing because we can give a better product, more relevant product to a smaller customer, but at the appropriate cost because currently it would be too expensive to have someone wandering around Lime Street brokering that business because there's not enough premium on it.
I think complexity or risk is the point there, isn't it? You know, I think we definitely see that as the market will look at elements of risk that are commoditized and need less risk selection, if you like, that and that's happened and there's a place for that to more efficiently deliver a product to a client base. Is that the classic client base of the Lloyd's market and of us? A small part of what we do, I would say. Some of our clients certainly are accessing that business and looking at ways in which they can very adeptly turn around underwriting submissions into policies, but it tends to be in relatively simple, very benign areas of business. And so as you add complexity, you struggle a bit, in my mind.
Or you give delegated authority to people who are able to do that and solve those problems for you, or to bring their expertise to slightly higher volume, lower premium business.
Yeah. I mean, do you want to build infrastructure or do you want to structure it through delegation? I think those are live discussions on how do you want to access risk? What's the best way of doing it? Do you want to build a local presence? Do you want to back someone who's got that local presence? So all choices, really.
Well, actually, that brings me to another point you said about building a local presence. In terms of expansion, could we ever see Dale in different hubs around the world?
I'm always nervous of saying anything to you that says we're definitely not going to do this because...
Well, I suppose you never rule anything out. There's always one thing.
Exactly. I think in our minds, though, building from scratch something overseas is unlikely. Certainly in the next 5-7 years or so, I think it would distract us from our opportunity that we have within the Lloyd's market that we think has got plenty of headroom for us. It's possible to do something through acquisition, but I don't think we'd build something from scratch.
And again, so you mentioning acquisition, is that now on potentially on the cards? Obviously, when you have capital available to you, and it probably wasn't something that was available before.
It is. I think it's not something that...
It's not the time now, necessarily.
Right, yeah.
One would expect to see lots of M&A.
Yeah, exactly. But we're in a different position where we can consider it. We never even thought about it in our first 10 years.
But at least now it's a question you can entertain.
Right.
Which is always interesting, but nice to sort of be challenged on other things.
Yes. And even if it's not acquisition, actually having that thought process to how people want to structure their businesses and how we may be able to help beyond pure box taking underwriting risk is a worthwhile debate to our minds.
Well, we can talk about some of those ideas. Let's just talk about the market. Actually, on AI, just to kind of clear it away, it seems that your philosophy on AI is more it's an enhancing thing, something that might enhance the underwriting process, help better inform an underwriter, but not something that's ever going to really take the place of an underwriter.
Underwriting and claims management, actually. Yeah. You know, I think you think about how much information is stored in this market in claims files. Huge amount of information that would tell us a lot about the qualitative factors of how to best handle the claims most efficiently, get the funds in the right place.
That's interesting. And you forget, we do forget about it.
Yeah.
Well, the journalists, we don't talk about claims nearly enough.
Yeah, super important. I think, you know, in our industry, we've got underwriters put the risks on the books and claims people that take those off. Every claim at some point is going to get settled. And so the most efficiently you can do that and with the best outcome for the customer and remove some of the waste in the system. Your topic was AI, and just think about how many millions of pages of claims reports we've got sat in files that don't tell us anything, that we can't garner any information out of, and now we can.
All those loss adjuster reports that we all just flick to the back page and say, so what are they recommending?
Yeah.
Because the other bit, I don't really care about the buckled connector or whatever it was. I don't even know what he's talking about. Right. But, you know, the bit at the bottom, how much is it?
Yeah, yeah. But genuinely interested in qualitative approach to managing claims. And yes, alluded to earlier, an awful lot of data in the system that's waste, that doesn't tell us anything.
Something to say, you know what, every time we've done this before, we've always settled around this. So why don't we offer them to settle around this about now and save ourselves the bother of all the hard work? Or, you know, every other claim of this nature has settled around here. Why don't we go straight to that, or straight to maybe, you know, we could offer them 10% less than that and see if we can get away with it. Or actually every other claim of this nature we've fought and we've always won. So we should go straight and be quite aggressive. So we're not paying this and we'll see you in court. And that's the best way of handling it, because that will make them go away quickly because they already know it won't work.
Yeah. Those are two good examples of outputs, I think, that you can pull out of the data, you know, and for those.
So it's like having a very, very experienced claims person, he said, who's got this encyclopedic knowledge, of course, which I'm sure you've got in your organization. Everyone's got one.
And we do. And we've got a fantastic claims team that will recount all the stories of what went well and what went not so well. It's pulling that into something that helps them with the strategy on the next one.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. Because I remember when Tom Bolt came in, as performance director. In fact, I'll probably get that job title wrong. I'll put that in the notes, because I remember he took over from Rolf Tolle, and every time that person's had a new job, they've always got a new job title to go with it. And I can't remember what his job title was at the time. But I remember we had him at a conference and he said, yeah, I don't want your claims departments just to be traffic cops for US lawyers.
Right.
And we haven't really revisited that. Actually said, I think we were talking about then about the context of about £600 to £700 million being spent on legal fees within the market. And then obviously the market's probably trebled in size since then. So it's probably pushing £2 billion by now. But I don't know, unless we've got better at it. But it's a good thought, because there's a huge amount in there that one presumes could be improved.
Well, I think we work on the basis that nothing's perfect. And so it's not a campaign against the legal profession.
We all know we need them, but perhaps sometimes we instruct them when we don't need them. And that is silly. And that's wasting their time.
It's wasting their time and ours. And so how can we work together? And I'm sure this is happening. This is nothing revolutionary, but it's something where I feel that the use of better analytics will get us to a better answer, actually. Some of the quantitative things that you look at in terms of managing claims, you know, don't ultimately tell you a great deal whether someone's reserved appropriately or not on an individual case. Because guess what? Reserve the next one a bit higher and settle it a bit lower. And is that a good answer? It's not the answer you're after, is it?
It's not like a motor claim where it's a fender bender and you know exactly what a fender costs.
I would say that's one of the challenges of claims and underwriting in London, actually, is how much credibility is there behind the data that we're looking at for each individual situation.
Yeah, and that goes back to this Blueprint 2 thing, because it's going to be the beginning building blocks of just a bit of better data, because none of this is going to work unless we flow some better data through all these systems. If you analyze a load of rubbish data, you're going to get some really stupid answers.
Yeah, and just do it in robust systems that work, and one version of the truth be good. Yeah.
We should probably talk about the market. 1/1/24 was much nicer. Well, it was still tough, but it was a far more predictable renewal season in reinsurance. Did that make things much easier for you business planning wise and knowing when you've got these opportunities and knowing you could get support from reinsurers and knowing what price it was likely to be quite a long way beforehand? Did that make everything easier?
I think it was easier. As a buyer of reinsurance, I think there was capacity there. I don't think there was abundant capacity, but certainly capacity that had grown through probably retained earnings as opposed to fresh capital coming in droves.
It's all money in the end.
But it was good enough. And I think more settled from a pricing standpoint. We've got good long relationships, as most people do. So there's a good understanding of things. And if things are relatively calm on the inward side, then that helps with those discussions too. And so as a seller of reinsurance, it was relatively calm, I would say, and still moving in the right direction.
Did it end up changing your balance at all? The balance is always changing, one presumes.
It changes modestly, but certainly the reinsurance equation for us didn't really change the balance, actually.
The most interesting point of debate in the reinsurance market over last year and also coming into those renewals was a difference of opinion about casualty. Well, I'd say casualty is a class that is always had differences of opinion. Anything, the longer the tail, the more difference of opinion you can have and the bigger consequence of that difference of opinion, you know, because as things compound, and you're an expert in casualty. Where did you sit on that debate?
I've got to give you a good answer here. I think for us, let me just put it into context. You know, we write a healthcare book, which has some international casualty element to it, international exposures, but most of our exposures are US. And that's really what we've concentrated on as a business other than the healthcare piece. I think often as an underwriter, you reflect back on all the things that you said no to, and we said no to an awful lot of things. And you think, well, I'm sure we didn't see all the good things either, but we said no to an awful lot of things that we couldn't understand why anybody would write those. And if you applied a moderate level of inflation to the claims experience that you're being shown on those accounts, that would get you to an answer which isn't very attractive from a margin standpoint.
Yeah.
And yet that gets written and has been written significantly. And I'd say particularly on the reinsurance side, we would point to that where you're more vulnerable to getting the inflation assumptions wrong.
And I suppose because of the US market, you're not using indexation clauses on some of these excess of loss.
Sadly not, no. Those are way in the past, I'm afraid. And also compounded because a number of those programs, the client, quite rightly, is buying bigger limits. And so you're more vulnerable to inflation in what you sold them previously, but now you've compounded that by adding additional limit that may not have had historical claims activity, but it's not worth nothing, is it? Yeah. So I think from a US casualty treaty side, we've been very defensive on that, I would say, since we started the syndicate, which was not historically, my experience. We had a big casualty treaty book in previous syndicate, but we felt that the dynamics had shifted so that the original pricing of the business was going down, and that was going down largely because frequency of loss was reducing, not because of severity.
Yeah.
And reinsurance terms were going down and or adding additional limit. And the compound of the two of those didn't really leave you with a very attractive...
A long fuse on a bomb and waiting for it to go off, isn't it, really?
Yeah. And just a personal view of what we saw at the time led us to saying no more often, I would say. We still do it.
But do you feel now it's in a better place? Markets are human and emotional, and you hadn't written, you declined most of those back in, say, that 2005 to 2020 period that we talk about. And that was the time, obviously, we probably were offered a lot of... As you're starting up, you do tend to get offered not necessarily all the best risks first, do you? Where the opportunities lie in a softer market, obviously that's where there are opportunities because they're the least well-priced things. And I suppose everyone starting up a business knows that that's likely to happen. But those people who wrote those risks are now maybe feeling remorseful. And obviously now in their emotional state is different from you. Do you feel good about yourself that you didn't write those risks and therefore have more appetite now that they are better priced?
I think the adequacy is definitely coming up. It's good to look back and feel that you've made some good decisions. But it comes back to what's the motivation of the business. You know, are we motivated to be bigger or quarterly earnings or any of those things? And that's not the driver of this business. The driver of this business is to be good underwriters and good custodians of the capital that is pledged to us. And we don't get everything right. So we're not sat here looking at others saying, why did you do that? And we are seeing certainly a good level of price correction on that business, as you would expect. And so it's getting to the point where we will probably say yes a bit more often than we have done.
And with casualty in general, and casualty treaty more specifically, is it more an art of avoiding the bad things that really, really hurt you than picking the good ones? Oh, they're all bad to a certain degree, and obviously some are just less bad, and therefore that makes them good.
No, definitely not. I think there's probably not just two camps, I'm afraid. I think you can have an incredibly, we're talking treaty, an incredibly skilled, knowledgeable, smart cedent that's got very cheap reinsurance because they're very good. Or you've got that where the reinsurance equation works for both parties. And equally, you can have a less good quality cedent with amazing terms, and you can still probably make money on that. And there's variations all the way through.
Good risk, bad risk, but there's only no such thing as a good risk or bad risk, just wrong pricing, wrong term.
There are extremes, though. You know, if you don't believe them and you don't believe...
You've got to underwrite that cedent.
Yeah, sure.
And then pick the ones that you do really like and you really trust them, you think they're really good and you rate them.
It's always a better starting point, isn't it? I mean, the ones that are more difficult tend to be more opportunistic type situations, I would say.
The best ones are people you've been reinsuring for 20 years and got a really good two-way relationship.
Yeah.
In this market, assessing the state of the market, we've had great inflows of business into London, into Lloyd's, and in general into the excess and surplus lines market from the admitted market in the US. Any signs of that peaking or ebbing away?
No, quite the opposite, actually. I think we've got an interesting dynamic that we're seeing a huge flow into the E&S market. I believe that's really driven by that dynamic where the primary admitted markets are not able to get the rate or the change in terms and conditions that they feel that they need to price some of those risks. And they also don't have a reinsurance partner who's subsidizing that anymore. Yeah. And so that shifts that business into the E&S market. And yeah, I think we're, to your question, I'm not sure that's necessarily a cyclical thing. There's no doubt there'll be an element of cyclicality about it. And hopefully the regulators will allow the primary carriers at some point to charge what they need to get the terms and conditions to serve their customer base on a more stable base.
So you're saying it's because the nature of the risk is changing, and so it's something that's not really suited to admitted lines anymore. And I suppose we could say, we'd go back to that property example. Yeah. You know, you'd say it was the most static risk, obviously, because it is static, literally. It's sitting there. It's a building. Yeah. I can go and see it, and I can touch it, and I can look and see it where it is on the map. But now, of course, the risk to that building is far more dynamic than it used to be, because you've got wildfire risk and severe convective storm risk, that things that you would never have thought of. Not to say they didn't exist, but they didn't imperil to the same degree as they do now.
Yeah. Claims are bigger and more expensive, more frequent. And yeah, if the primary pricing is unable to keep pace with that, then it pushes it into the E&S market, I think. And we're starting to see business in the E&S market in territories that we've never seen it, not in my lifetime. So that is interesting.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
So you think, yes, there's some permanent trends here rather than just things. Of course, we know there's always a bit of ebb and flow in the market, but permanent trends.
But the difference, I think, in pricing between what's available, admitted, and what is needed, effectively, almost everyone agrees on what's needed, is big enough to keep it out for some time, I would say.
Yeah. Oh, excellent. Yeah. Well, good. So lots of opportunity and not looking like you can start battening down the hatches again.
It's dynamic, isn't it? And most underwriters tend to refer to the one that they've lost to an aggressive competitor. But in the aggregate, it's a positive market, I think, and reasons why it should continue to be.
All aggressive competitors are bandits, aren't they? Yes. The other people. It's the other people are bandits.
It's always someone else, isn't it? But, you know, and there always is one. So.
Yeah, and of course, sometimes it's you, but that's not how you think of yourself.
Couldn't possibly comment that.
As I was doing some research before this interview and looking at all things that have changed, something that I noticed had changed, or that certainly the messaging around it had changed, was partnerships. And there's something perhaps now with the CVC relationship that you're going to be targeting partnership as a way of growing, another way of doing things. Can you give me a bit more detail about that?
Yeah, sure. We've commented a bit more on it than we have done in the past. I think it's been a feature. And for us, the partnerships are with whoever we're trading with. And that could be lawyers or adjusters or brokers or clients or reinsurers, capital. What we're referring to there, I think, in partnerships is more about, now we have a managing agency in Lloyd's and we have an opportunity, I think, as a marketplace, and we see it, to look at the creative use of Lloyd's paper, licensing, branding, credit ratings, to bring insurance, reinsurance solutions to clients. And for us, we've got opportunity, I think, through strategic partnerships that we've developed over the years, and some that we may develop on a new basis to look at how can we be creative about bringing that solution to those clients. And that could take all sorts of forms. It could be an SPA or a syndicate in a box, or it could be a portfolio within the syndicate. Depends on the scale.
It could be a sell in London Bridge or all sorts of things.
Yeah, so lots of ways that we should be looking at the incredible advantages that Lloyd's paper brings to a client base. Capital efficiency, the branding and the credit ratings, particularly licensing across territories.
And also, I suppose, is that you've got that ability to deploy the innovation class. What percentage of your stamp can it be?
I think we can do 2%. 2%. I think but I think you mentioned about golden age of Lloyd's. So I think, you know, Lloyd's is open for that, I think. And we feel that there's a much more positive environment to build on all of the good work that's been done through the remediation phase.
So you could be turnkeying some things?
Yeah, I think not in a classic sense.
Not as a part of your business model. Say, oh, let's have some fee earning bits over here and let's do turnkeys. More that they'd be strategically important to you. But
we're an underwriting business. And so I think our interest in doing it would not be to build a fee business per se. It would be that we can utilize the resources that we've got in order to host something where ideally we agree with the underwriting opportunity there and we're participating and helping bring capital to the table, as opposed to, you know, I don't think we're well set up to be turnkeying and nurturing new startup businesses. You know, I think that's a different skill set. There are those that are very good at that. That's not us. It's really more mature businesses of scale where Lloyd's paper is.
You can do something together.
Where we can do something together and say, well,
right. Yeah. And they haven't got Lloyd's access, and you could be that point of access for them. It sounds like it's quite an eclectic idea that you're very open-minded. You don't have a set idea of what you're targeting, but you want to perhaps signal that you are open to these kinds of discussions.
We're open to those discussions, and they could take a number of forms, I think, in terms of the actual structure that suits all parties.
Duncan, I think we've come to the end of whatever I had written down on a piece of paper. But have we missed anything? You've got a smile on your face. You're looking happy. You're looking like you're enjoying life. So if there's nothing to add, I'd very much like to thank you for the time.
Yeah, thank you. I think we are enjoying it. I think, you know, you mentioned about being in a good market and looking back and saying, well, why were we all still miserable then? You know? I'm excited by the opportunities in the market. And we want to be a part of that. And so I think it's an exciting time for us as a business and plenty of opportunities ahead. So, to enjoy it.
Come back on the show at some point in the future and tell us all about it.
Look forward to it. Thank you very much.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, don't forget to subscribe or leave a like or a review or recommendation on whatever podcast platform you used to access this programme. These really help get the word out. Before we go, just a quick reminder that advertising slots are available here and in other places in the Voice of Insurance podcasts. Podcasting is the fastest growing medium and attracts a high quality audience of key decision makers. It's also an intimate medium where you, the listener, are right in the room with me and the interview subjects. Needless to say, that means it's a great way of getting your message out directly to an audience because you know you've got their full attention. It's also very cost effective. So get in touch with Mark at thevoiceofinsurance.com to find out how you could be speaking directly to the industry. The Voice of Insurance podcast is produced in association with Advantage Go, enabling enterprise-scale underwriting through a single pane of glass. Voice of Insurance is produced by me, Mark Gagan. Music was written by Anna Gagan and produced by Carlos Gagan. Check out more podcasts and written comment pieces at www.thevoiceofinsurance.com.